Gavin Woods Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Richard Clapton, and I'm on Gavin Woods Podcast.
On this podcast, I'm so happy to introduce Australia's singer, songwriter, guitarist and producer, one of the guys that's still doing it after all these years, Richard Clapton. Hello.
Hey, Gavin, how are you?
Mate, I'm fine. I said this to Joe Camilleri once, but and I think you fit into the same category. You're the travelling troubadour.
Yes. I thought you were going to say travelling Wilburys, almost. I actually talked to Joe years ago about putting a band together called the Travelling Willoughbys.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
For Victorian listeners, Willoughby's the suburb of Sydney, yes, actually quite close to where I live.
It's where Channel 9 is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You got it.
Hey, mate, I want to talk first up. I want to talk about your shows because it's so important to people to come and see you because you are just a brilliant live act. And you're at the Palms at the Crown in South Bank, Friday, the 22nd of July. Tickets, only a few left, so you've got to get onto that very quickly. And then Friday, the 26th of August at the Gov in Adelaide. They are going to be two sellout and brilliant shows.
Which I really look forward to because, I'm regular. Well, at least once a year at the Palms, although this might be my second time in the Palms in less than 12 months, and also for the Gov. But it's always great, no matter, you know, even if I do it more than once a year, we still get a good turnout for it.
Right. Well, Richard, let's go right back, but I want to find out how music came into your life.
Well, I actually, I started out life wanting to be a fashion illustrator.
Okay.
Way back in the day, I mean, rather than fashion photographs, young artists used to do illustration of, you know, of those fashions for Vogue, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I wanted to do when I was a teenager. And I actually, you'd have to read my book about my meeting with the Rolling Stones when I was a kid and how I met up with Keith Richard, who was also had been an art student. And his advice to me was to get myself over to London and go to this art school called St. Martin's in the Field, which he was saying was probably the best art school in the world. So I did. I made the pilgrimage. And once I was in London, I mean, I'd already played music just with friends from school. Then I had this epiphany one night with Bob Dylan, and I just decided I want to be that guy.
Yeah.
So then I started to take music seriously. So I probably started out writing songs in the late 60s in London.
Okay. Now, the book is called The Best Years of Our Lives, and it's basically a memoir. It looks at the fans as well.
I really haven't held back that part of my history anyway. And I'd like to think that somebody had to do it. Somebody had to document, especially the Australian music scene, really the way it was.
Mm.
So, you know, it encompasses Benny's, Gavin, I'm sure you know, Benny's in Potts Point in Sydney, a well-known speakeasy.
Spent a lot of time there.
I know. Well, I mean, you weren't really in the industry if you didn't go to Benny's.
That's true.
But now I tell tales of Benny's and you know, the Bondi Lifesaver and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and my daughters who are now, I've got twin daughters, and they're now 31 years old.
Right.
But they when they read the book, they just marvelled at the life we used to have back in those days.
Yeah, it was a good life. Now, daughters are very proud of Dad?
Yes, and they still come to my gigs.
Fantastic.
That's one great. Lives in Sydney, the other lives in Melbourne.
Uh-huh.
Saskia, who lives in Melbourne, comes to pretty much every Melbourne gig that I do. As recently as about a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
I did a little run of three gigs in Melbourne. And, yes, they are. They are. They're proud of Dad and vice versa. Dad's very proud of them.
Yeah, it's great. I've got two daughters and two boys, and I just love them dearly. You just want to wrap them in your arms and hug them tight, don't you?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. And also, you just really, honestly, life just moves so fast. It's like, is that it?
I know. Just
to digress, I had a really fun week on, speaking of birthdays and age and everything, on Daydream Island in Queensland with Daryl Braithwaite.
I saw the footage on Facebook. That looked fantastic.
I know. Well, did you see the photo of Daryl and I cracking up?
Yes.
On the boat?
Well, yes, I did.
The story behind that is so it was my birthday and Daryl was having fun and I said, well, Daryl, I just worked out because I'm actually looking into getting my catalogues back, my recording catalogues back.
Excellent.
So I had to go through all my old contracts. And I signed to Festival Records on the 6th of June, 1972.
Right.
And so I said to Daryl, I'm pretty sure Sherbet would have signed, and both the same label, by the way. So this is my 50th year, and I know it's your 50th year. So let's do a 100th anniversary tour. And that's when he cracked up I cracked up laughing with him.
Now tell me, Richard, what made you, in the early years, before you had Girls on the Avenue and the success, the early success, what was the motivation to go to Germany and London?
So many musicians come from art schools, you know, when you think about it. Leo Sayer, Reg Mombassa, you know, Reg Mombassa is still an incredible artist. Yes. Then what happened is the third band I had, and by the way, I always had Richard Clapton bands, and I was always writing the songs pretty much from day one. And then I formed a band with, two Californians and a Canadian. And we played around for a few months. And at that stage, I was really intimidated by drugs. I was a real late bloomer when it came to drugs. So there you go. There's a double-edged sword I just gave you. In my youth, I was really anti-drugs, and then that turned around. but anyway, what happened is because we were all living in the same block of flats in London, they were actually importing pot from California. Remember those little Kodak film canisters, the little cylindrical black...
Yeah, with the grey cap. Yeah.
Yeah. And all these stupid kids were doing, and we were kids, you know, and they were getting pot sent from California just by the post. Anyway, so one night there was a big bust, and a lot of people got carted away. But because, the cops, I mean, I just didn't do drugs, simple as that. However, one of the cops, you know, there's always good cop and bad cop, and bad cop had it in for me. So he's looked at my passport, seen that I'd overstayed my welcome by over a year. So I'd been there a bit over 4 years. And he insisted I leave the country. He gave me 7 days to leave the country. And that's how I ended up in Berlin.
Gotcha. Okay. And then you started to amass songs for Prussian Blue, right, in 73?
Yes. Well, prior to that, I had a German band, and the German band was actually called Sopwith Camel. And we were very close to a deal with a company called Kinney, which was the forerunner to Warner's Warner Music. And we were so close to it, and we didn't realize that there was a big American band called Sopwith Camel, and they were signed to Universal. The record company in Munich got a nasty letter from Universal in the States to say that we didn't change our name, and they made a couple of veiled threats. So we lost the record deal, which was obviously a real bummer because we were looking good until then. So I actually ended up we'd invested so much money in our career because I was in Berlin for about 2.5 years.
Right.
And so I ended up, a friend who had married into wealth, put it that way. And they'd relocated to New York. They had a big, what do you call it, a mansion, really, in Berlin, in a suburb called Wannsee, which is the last stop on the rail station in Berlin. Mm. And I lived there happily with no money at all for 6 months, which is pretty interesting when you think about it. Yeah. I had no money and I'm living in a big mansion.
were you busking or anything? How are you making money?
Yeah. I used to busk on the street. I also used to sell leather goods made by the South American guy, which were fantastic, by the way.
Right.
So, I'd hawk the leather goods to the tourists and busk and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, I had a bit of money coming in. Pretty much all the songs from that album were written in Berlin.
Right.
And but I want to be a survivor. I actually wrote, because by the time I got back here, I was so desperately broke. I couldn't get a job, et cetera, et cetera. So I was living in pretty crappy flats, you know, really cheap flats in Sydney. And I was actually living in a flat in the Cross in Sydney. And those were the days when King's Cross is sort of like the Wild West.
Yes.
And so I want to be a survivor. I actually wrote, because I had a view of the harbour looking out my window.
Okay.
And I wrote that one afternoon looking out the window at the harbour, and, you know, hence a lot of, you know, the lyric, what I'm talking about, you know.
Yeah.
Out on the harbour and blah, blah, blah.
Absolutely. Now, your early influences, Jackson Browne, Bruce Springsteen, they kind of shaped your sound. But tell me, in 75, Girls on the Avenue, for every DJ listening to this, Girls on the Avenue was one of our favourite songs and we played it to death.
Yes.
We loved it.
Well, I was living with a guy called Colin Verco, and Colin was, he was the artist liaison with Festival Music Publishing, which is a song publisher. So Festival Records threatened to drop me from the label because Prussian Blues sold fairly, you know, pretty poorly. Mm. The managing director said, you either come up with a radio-friendly hit single or you're going to drop you from the label. And I was still pretty rebellious in those days.
Oh, no, we loved you, mate. It's okay.
Well, I was the enfant terrible of the Australian music scene. But anyway, Colin kept at me and at me, and Festival kept rejecting the song because they kept saying, so every Tuesday they had what you call an artist and repertoire committee, and they would decide what singles were going to go out and, you know, what albums were going to go out, et cetera. Yeah. And they kept rejecting Girls on the Avenue. And because Colin had, you know, had been at me for months to, you know, coerce me into writing a song like this, he just became more and more agitated. And he started arguing with them.
Right.
And over a number of meetings, they kept rejecting it. And Colin's go, what is the matter with you people? And they say, well, the song's a mess. I mean, what's the chorus? What is it? Don't you slip? Friday night, see the girls. What's the chorus?
Oh,
and in the interim, Colin went to he was going to lunches with Ron and Marius, who founded Double J.
Right,
and they offered him a job as the first music programmer for Double J. And so he finally went to lunch with Ron and Marius. They gave him the job. They got pretty drunk to celebrate. Yeah. He came back to Festival. And they were just coming out of their A&R meeting. And he said, well, what, do you get it? Yeah, you know, he was really pretty pretty agitated.
Mm.
And they just repeated, no, you know, we just, you know, we don't get it. You know, we just don't think much of the song. And Colin actually took a swing at one of the executives.
I love it. That's passion. That's passion.
No, here's the bit you're going to love. The punchline, literally, pardon the pun, punchline was, you're fired. And Colin said, you can't fire me. I've just taken a job at Double J and I'm their first music programmer. Look, Gavin, that just prior to you talking about Australian, you know, mainstream radio getting right behind Girls on the Avenue.
Yeah.
I think that was because Colin has revenge. This is the only time I've ever experienced corruption on my side of the fence. Because Colin was playing Girls on the Avenue. When Double J first started, he was playing once on the hour every hour. Every day.
Good on him. God love him.
And then finally, you know, 3XY music programmers, et cetera, or 2SM, they started hearing it and going, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
And so you guys picked it up and there you go. Rest is history.
Well, yeah, the rest is history. History, a number one song for you. And I bet when he said, I just picked up the programming job at Double J, I bet all those executives did such, they kind of tried to wind it all back. Oh, mate, oh, we're going to need you. It's the ultimate revenge, isn't it?
They also rejected a request, I think it was for a $500 advance for an American songwriter. And Colin was going, are you people mad? And anyway, I think about five or six years later, this writer came out with this record called Born to Run.
Oh, that's precious. That is fantastic. You can tell all these stories now,
yeah,
can't you, mate?
Yeah, great.
the ultimate revenge. It's fantastic. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Richard Clapton, and I'm on Gavin Wood's podcast.
Now, after Girls on the Avenue and the success, the number one success and all the touring and everything like that, did you go back to Berlin?
I went back to Berlin regularly.
Oh, okay.
I was always for a number of months, 4 or 5 months. Sometimes I think the longest I went back was about 18 months.
Did you go back to get material for songs?
I actually got a grant. They funded me to fly around the world and write songs. That's what it was for. No, so it's actually the reverse. I actually used that money, and my friends in Berlin all went to Berlin University. And so just say, you know, uni students in Melbourne probably, I don't know, go down the Great Ocean Road or somewhere, or the Gold Coast or whatever, in their summer break. Well, in the winter break in Berlin, they go to the Scandinavian countries.
Right.
So we were in this big old, it was quite a large house, in a place called Nørre Nebel, and northernmost tip of Denmark. Right. Its claim to fame is that Brigitte Bardot, I don't know if she still owned a house there, but she was a frequent visitor. And it's pretty much just a little fishing. Oh, although Elton John did an album up around that place.
Okay.
After that, but I scored the attic in this house, and the Germans were all downstairs, and I've always found it really curious because I was sitting up in this little attic, and really it was so cold. It was 30 degrees below zero. It was so cold the beach was iced over.
Ooh.
I mean, it was just, that's how cold it was. But I don't know if I was pining for the fields, but I don't know about you, I've always found it really fascinating that I was in the northernmost tip of the Antipodes, and I was writing a song like Down in the Lucky Country about the southernmost tip of the Antipodes. So, in other words, a song about Bondi Beach.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's just strange how things work out. I think we were there, we're not all that long, probably 3 or 4 weeks, but I wrote most of the Goodbye Tiger album. In that little attic in Denmark.
Did you record that in the States?
No. No, I was persuaded to come back here by Phil Matthews. Phil, I think most recently he became John Williamson's manager. But Phil's a lovely man, and I'd had a dispute with the festival, and I was a bit over them. And I had the intention of, like, bugger this, you know, I'm going to go back to Europe and try and restart my career.
Right.
But Phil, you know, as I said, he was a lovely man, and he said, well, you still owe us one album. And he guaranteed me that if I came back, he would ensure that I got total artistic freedom and, you know, that a lot of the problems that I had in the 70s with festival, he promised he would take care of them, et cetera, et cetera. So I did, and I came back, and I had total artistic freedom. So I wrote a 6-minute song, which all radio programmers loved, because the only time you got to go to the bathroom, and that was deep water. You loved that song, didn't you, Gavin?
Yes.
You could put it on and
loved
go
it, loved
pizza.
It, loved it. Yes. And yeah, mate, it was a great song. Yeah. Like what? I think I was at 4BC, and the studios are on the second floor, and the toilets were up on the third floor. So you had to run up the back stairs quick.
So let's play Deep Water or Stairway to Heaven, depending on how long you're going to take.
Mate, no, we thank you for that. Now, tell me about John Farris and you producing an album, and then they produced an album for you. Tell me about all of that, because that's very interesting. That's kind of in the start of the 80s, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I produced an album called Dark Spaces, which contains Get Back to the Shelter, and I produced that myself. That was my first, the first album I'd ever produced by myself.
Uh-huh.
After that, I went back to Berlin, and I'd been gone for a few months, but I'd had a long history with Chris Murphy, you know, tragically passed away.
Great man. He loved his axe, didn't he, Chris?
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy, did he love his axe. Anyway, I returned from Europe. I was jet lagged, and really tired, and I just wanted to go to bed. And he called me up, and he was a pretty bombastic sort of character.
Yes.
And he was raving and raving about this band called In Excess. And I go, yeah. And he told me they were playing in a pub in Paddington in Sydney called the Paddington Green Hotel.
Right.
And they're going to be on at midnight. And I went, yeah, well, good, I'll have a nice time. And he said, mate, you've got to come see this band. And the way he was describing them, it was like I could tell they were new wave. And I remember saying to Chris, oh, man, I'm not going to drag myself out of bed. And I don't think the weather was really very nice either. You know, come and see your band. Sounds like Flock of Seagulls. So, you know, I'm going back to bed.
Right.
However, Chris could be a real bully. So I turned up to the Paddington Green Hotel, and truly there was 9 local drunks. I know it was 9 because I counted them, because it was the only place they could get a drink after midnight, see?
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so it was just Chris Murphy, myself, and 9 local drunks. Now, this young band came out, and I you know, before they started, I was really skeptical. And one thing I always try and add into the mix is, you know, I'd already been a professional musician for about 12, 13 years. And it was like, you know, if you've only got 20 people or less, it's like, hey, fellas, you know, a good set's a short set.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, trying to, get out of there as soon as you can. But not In Excess. They came on stage and immediately just blew me away. I just couldn't believe it.
Right.
Because, you know, I don't think they were trying to impress me. It's truly the In Excess that I've known and loved for so long. That's just them. You know, they're sort of doing it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they played with this passion and panache that I very rarely experienced before. Mm-hmm. So at the end of their gig, I went into the dressing room and we just immediately hit it off. Now, Johnny Farris was really young. Johnny Farris was only about 17 on this particular night.
Mm.
But he sort of latched onto me, despite the fact that he's one of the 3 brothers in that band.
Yeah.
He sort of latched onto me like a big brother, like almost automatically. Mm. And because I didn't realise what was behind this is they loved the album that I produced myself, Dark Spaces. They liked the sound of it, they liked the attitude of it, and they liked the playing, et cetera, et cetera. So that's when they told me they wanted to do a cover of The Loved One. By the band, legendary Australian band, The Loved Ones.
Yeah, that was a hit for them.
And I said, well, yeah, I mean, I can't promise anything because I've only just produced myself. I don't know if I could produce anyone else. But we went into the studio. I produced The Loved One for them. I think we went top 10 with that.
You did?
It was great. And so it was just, it became automatic. And then, you know, because The Loved One had been, you know, enough of a success, they asked me to do their second album, which was Underneath the Colours.
Right, okay. And what about the Great Escape album? That was produced by, John Farris and Mark Opitz?
No, that was Mark Opitz. No, well, so In Excess was still a fledgling band.
Right.
They were just about to break,
mm-hmm.
but they were the flavour of the month. Like, you know, it was so cool to be into In Excess.
Yeah.
So Mark Opitz produced The Great Escape, and he hadn't, at that stage, hadn't met In Excess, didn't know anything about them, but I'd been raving to Mark about how great In Excess was, and I played him a bit of what I was doing with In Excess, and Mark just said, oh, mate, that drummer. And I said, oh, yeah, Johnny Farris, greatest white drummer in the world today.
Mm.
At 17, mind you.
Mm.
And so we got Johnny in, and Johnny did pretty much the whole of the Great Escape album.
Okay.
And that's where our relationship really clicked in.
Right.
And it endured for 40 years.
Well, Diamond Mind, the album critically acclaimed, that took 4 years to write. And you self-produced that one too?
Well, that was in a really wonderful age in the new millennium, which is
2003.
Yeah, because with the advent of this technology, which I think most of the public are now aware of, instead of going into $5,000 a day studios, which I really miss, by the way. I mean, I'm sure you do as well.
I do. I do every day.
Yeah, but you know, sadly, it's just not like that anymore. Everything's done on a laptop. So I had a great studio under my house, and a fan of mine who's a multimillionaire insisted that he wanted to invest in an album of mine. And so he bankrolled the Diamond Mine album. And, God, that was a happy time. And so the thing is so liberating. No producer, no engineer. Like, you know, with home recorder, you do everything yourself. You engineer it yourself.
Yeah.
You obviously produce yourself and play most of the stuff yourself. So, I just potted around with that for ages, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. That financier, that wasn't Rod Muir, was it?
No, Rod Muir was Glory Road. I will see you skip Glory Road. Glory Road's a story to behold. But if I told you the Glory Road story, you probably wouldn't believe. I know you probably would because you probably knew Rod.
I worked there. So you got to tell me. You got to tell us. You got to tell us about Glory Road. Come on.
All right. Okay. It started with Rod Muir came bursting into my dressing room one night, and he was babbling on about what he thought of me, and he had a beige bonnet that I was the contemporary Banjo Paterson, that I was going to go on to be the Australian poet.
Yeah.
And so Rod befriended me. Now, I just played on Daydream Island, which is next to Hamilton Island. Rod had so much money, and he had those maxi yachts. He used to go into the what is that called? The race that. Hamilton Island yacht race, isn't it? I think.
Oh yes. What did he do? Did he do that with Windward Passage?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Oh, he did it with both Windward Passages. He did it.
They would have been the biggest yachts up there.
Yeah. No. But he started out with. You remember the original Windward Passage, the smaller wooden one.
Yeah.
But no. Yeah, they were that and Apollo. Anyway, so Rod, I'd already done a gig for Rod at the end of race week. And then he wanted to up the ante. And so I had INXS's rhythm section and Ian Moss on guitar. And I was doing a gig for Rod. And then Keith Williams, who owned Hamilton Island, was overseas and he heard about this gig. And he said to Rod, there's no way you're not putting a rock concert on my island, blah, blah, blah. And by this time, Rod was powerful and famous. And he wasn't going to be moved by this. And they got into an argument. It was a Mexican standoff. So Rod had these sand barges towed from Airlie Beach across Hamilton Island, moored them about 100 metres off Hamilton Island, and put this, because he was friends with Eric Robinson, you know, who owned all the PAs.
Yes. Dear Eric, what a great guy. I know. Yeah.
And they put this massive PA on these sand barges 100 metres off the shore of Hamilton Island. And we played for 5 hours.
Oh, that's brilliant. Rod Muir, he was Mr. FM, Triple M in Sydney, got that going. And 2SM, of course, that great radio station, which you would have done a lot of little singing IDs for.
Yep. How about a really quick one just to give the listeners a taste of what Rod was all about? I think his second Sydney to Hobart, he wanted Eric, going back to Eric Robinson, who owned all the PA in Australia. Rod, serious, I was there. And Rod seriously talked to Eric. If you remember how sardonic Eric was and the look on Eric's face when Rod wanted to put half of Eric's PA on South Head and the other on North Head. And he wanted to play ZZ Top at the start of race week.
Oh, what?
True story, mate. I
what a
there.
Visionary. Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Richard Clapton, and I'm on Gavin Wood's podcast.
Now, mate, congratulations. In 1999, Richard Clapton was inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame. That must have been a fun night for you.
It was really, I mean, it was pretty apt, really, because INXS actually inducted me into the Hall of Fame, so it was a very appropriate evening. And obviously a great honour.
Mm. No, it's they'll never take that off you.
No, it's still here.
Now... 2014, of course, your book, The Best Years of Our Lives, came out. Now, I've got to read that. I'm going to make a mental note for that.
Yeah.
2015, Mark Moffat, my good mate. He and I started playing in bands at the Open Door in Brisbane.
Is that a fact?
He came from Maryborough. I started my radio career at 4MB in Maryborough. So he produced the House of Orange, put some great Nashville players in behind you.
I mean, the best. I mean, like, just for the listeners, I mean, Dan Dugmore, who plays most of the guitar. Dan is the guitar player on Linda Ronstadt's Blue Bayou. I think he's done 10 James Taylor albums, 10 Jackson Browne albums, numerous Stevie Nicks albums, et cetera, et cetera. So that's it. I mean, that was a pretty massive lineup that Mark got together in Nashville.
Now, tell me, you lived in the States over in the Valley. How long did you live there for?
I've lived in L.A. Briefly on a number of occasions, but my longest time was when Chuggy was my manager. And Chuggy took me to LA, and we actually lived there for about 2.5 years in Van Nuys, which is in the San Fernando Valley.
There is an urban myth. I just want to clear this up. But apparently you recorded an album, and the girl from the record company just adored you, thought you were going to be the next Bob Dylan. And then she got pregnant, left the record company, and the new guy came in and he didn't like your cassette. Is that true?
That was not just true. That was devastating. Because
I could imagine.
But do you remember George Wayne?
George Wayne, yeah, he was a DJ in Sydney.
He was a DJ in Sydney, but George worked on K-Rock in LA for 8 years. So George was close friends with Jackson Browne and Neil Young and Bob Dylan, etc.
Connected and nicely, yeah.
Now, George introduced Jackson Browne to me, and for a while there, Jackson took me under his wing. Jackson opened up doors for me in LA, mainly Electra Asylum, which was his own label. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I went and did demos for them. I think I demoed about 6 songs. And Carol, who was the A&R lady at the time, she was just rapt. And so I was just, I spent about 2 years just driving into LA from the Valley.
Yeah.
And having, you know, various meetings with them. I mean, they really had a big vision for me. Mm. But when that unfortunate altercation happened, when the heads of Warner's flipped Carol and replaced her with this guy, this other guy, who I'm not even going to name. Yes. Thank you. You took the word right out of my mouth. But... she, you know, she had been so devoted to me for, you know, almost a couple of years, you know, and this new guy really resented that. He didn't want anything. He wanted to wipe all traces of Carol, wipe the slate clean. But the story that I was told,
I understand.
By a published friend of mine who was actually in the building at the time. Said he heard this guy and he was just screaming at Carol, get out, get out. And he said Carol was in tears and trying to hand this guy the cassette, my demo cassette. And she said, look, I'm leaving. Can you please just hear this Richard Clapton guy? You know, he's great, et cetera, et cetera. And apparently this prick, as you call him, very apt word, because he got all the tape. He you know how people could wrench all the tape out of the cassette? Like all over the floor.
Yeah.
And smashed the plastic casing with his feet and said, get out of here and blah, blah, blah. And screw Richard Clapton. Yeah.
You're kidding me. Mate, you ended,
I ended up in the bin. And I think we really needed Alan Healy, the head of festival back in Australia, to really come in and intervene. And, but sadly, it never happened. And we quite bluntly, we ran out of money. You know, I'd spent 2.5 years there with half my band, really living off the Goodbye Tiger royalties. But like I said, all the money was gone, so we had to return to Australia.
You were so close to it, weren't you?
Oh, I was so close. In the book, I document how I actually, I've been offered 6 major overseas record deals. I mean, you know, Clive Davis was another one. Who at almost in that same time period. I mean, I had a couple of meetings with Clive, but unfortunately, when you know, I'll let me say this because I think if you've got any kids listening who really want to get into music, I just want to issue words of caution that, and I know Australian record companies are going to try and force you to sign for the world. And
yes.
It's very intimidating. And there's not a lot you can do about it, but just bear in mind when you sign for the world, that means you cannot go to London like I did. And even though Island Records really wanted to sign me, Island and myself were at the mercy of Festival back here. And Festival just wanted a stupid advance. They wanted £250,000. It's like stupid. Yeah. I mean, even though it was the 80s, you know. Remember, there's a lot of money around. And I'll never forget with Chris Blackwell, the owner of Island, saying, mate, you know what? So your stupid record company back there, they want 20 points for you, which is 20%. You know what? We just signed Steve Winwood for 14. Why are we going to give you 20? I went, I don't want 20 points. But that's when they said, Richard, you know what? You just don't get it. It's up to Festival Records. You can't do anything about it.
So frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah.
So frustrating. Man.
So, you know, very briefly, that's the sad side of my story overseas.
Yeah, well, thank God we've got you here, mate. Now, in 1975, you won Male Vocal for Girls on the Avenue, and in 2010, you're inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. That's a great achievement, mate, with all the songs you've written. You stand proudly in there.
I mean, it is always nice to get accolades. More in your backyard.
Yeah,
More in your backyard. Like I said, Daryl and I are pretty good mates. And when our paths cross, we often walk into hotel lobbies and all Daryl's friends are there. And Daryl go, I don't believe it. Richard Clapton, you're the king of pop. And I go, yes, that's me. I've been king of pop for 20 years. What was your name again? Oh, I'm Daryl Braithwaite. Oh, whatever. And the fans, his fans just stand there with their jaws on the floor going, what the hell is wrong with this picture?
On?
They both lost their minds.
But, mate, you've got to have that black humour, haven't you? You've got to have that humour just to keep going on the road.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I love the new album, Music is Love, 1966 to 1970. Man, you have brought back so many great memories from the Birds, the Love and Spoonful, the Young Bloods, and also Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Buffalo Springfield, and it goes on. The band, Neil Young, Allman Brothers, and the songs are just classic songs. It must have been a good labour of love for you, mate.
So now we're up to the present day. Now, a few years ago, Terry Blamey, who, as you know, but we tell the listeners, managed Kylie for pretty much all of her career, I think. And Terry recently retired. I got a gig in San Francisco, and I went over there, and I hung around Haight-Ashbury. So I was in San Francisco for about a month. I came back and went around to Terry's house, and we're having a bit of a night. And Terry said, you know, I was going on and on about San Francisco and how great it was. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, Terry went, you know what? Let's do an album of hippie anthems. And I kind of went, I don't know. I don't do covers, Terry. And he said, yeah, but think about it. And he was trying to give me really good reasons as to why I should seriously think about it. In the interim, Terry and the late, great Michael Gudinski were, best of friends. And Terry had mentioned this to Gudinski. And Gudinski's ears pricked up. And Gudinski got really interested. So Terry got back to him and he said, you know what? I talked to Michael about this, and Michael reckons it's a great idea, and he'd love to do it. And so Terry said to me, look, Richard, I know you don't do covers, but I've been your mate for a few years now, and I know so much about you. These iconic songs, it's really, you've told me, it's part of your musical DNA. This is your music, all these songs.
Yes.
So I warmed to the idea. Terry gave me 50 good reasons why I should seriously consider this album. And I did. And, within a couple of weeks, not only had I warmed the idea, I was really, excited about the idea. So over almost a year, we curated, I reckon, about 50 songs, which ultimately got culled down to the 15 right. that are on the album. And I'm going out and playing this on stage. You know, I do Summer in the City, and I've got, you know, about half my audience is pretty young now, even in the 20s. Mm. And these young kids, they hear me doing Summer in the City or you know, Get Together by the Young Bloods and go, wow, that's so cool. Did you write that? No.
A whole new audience, yeah. Richard. You've stayed with the times. It's great.
So,
and those songs, you know, they were the cornerstones of your career. If you think about all those songs, that's where you got your early influence to get in and make
it
music.
It is, you know, that's why there's two Neil Young songs on there, and I mean, probably the more obscure influence there is David Crosby. I don't think Crosby's I don't know that Australia is all that aware of David Crosby, but especially in the United States, David Crosby is a living legend.
Well, I'm gonna do a Molly here. Do yourself a favour and get Music Is Love by Richard Clapton, because you won't be disappointed. It is a high class, beautifully recorded album, and mate, you're singing better than ever.
Thanks, Kevin.
Mate, you've recorded over 20 albums and you've sold over 1 million copies, mate, and you're still going strong. You're going to sell a lot of copies of Music Is Love. Let me just go through the dates again. Friday the 22nd of July at South Bank at the Palms at Crown, which is a great stage, a great place to go and watch some rock and roll. And also Friday the 26th of August at the Gov Adelaide, and that's a great venue too. Mate, it's just been brilliant to talk to you. But before we go, I've got a couple of questions I want to ask you. Okay. Now, a couple of the questions. What effect did Countdown have on your career?
At first, I thought I was too cool for Countdown. And then I also had the altercation with Molly live on air.
Yes.
But then I think it was Gavin Wood, when I did the Countdown Spectacular Tour, he used to announce that for somebody who didn't particularly like Countdown, how come I'd done it 17 times?
That's exactly right. Hey, mate, you killed him on the Countdown Spectacular.
Oh, yeah, I know. I look back on Countdown with some of the best memories, because, God, that was a great show to do.
Now, mate, if you could open up a show for any artist, living or dead, who would it be?
Neil Young. 6-week Australian tour.
Ah.
And I didn't actually meet Neil until third night in, I think. And it was the Sydney Entertainment Centre. Anyway, I did a show. I did my set for 60 minutes, and it went pretty well. And I could feel this presence behind my amplifier. And I went to run off stage, and it was actually Neil. And he said, no, go and do an encore. And I said, no, it's not allowed. And he goes, I'm allowing it. Go and do an encore. So I went, okay. You know, Neil Young says do an encore, you do an encore. Well, I went out and did the encore, came on, and the encore went over really well. And while the crowd was still applauding, and he was almost in full view of the crowd. And he was wearing, you know, the big fringe Buffalo Bill jacket he sometimes wears? Wearing that. And he had his arm around me. And he went, so you're Ralph. Okay, you're a bad boy. You've got to let my band go to bed, man. Oh, sorry, Neil. Ah. I'm having too much fun. And he goes, yeah, you're having too much fun. So I'm retitling my tour, Ralph Never Sleeps.
Oh, man, that is so funny. Now, what's the most trouble Richard Clapton has ever gotten into?
One of my favourites is driving back down Highway 1, driving south. Harvey James and I had gone to a commune in Byron Bay, right, with his beautiful nymphets, who'd given us all this pot. And I've never been a huge pot smoker, right, but Harvey was a big pothead. So we're going down Highway 1, and we're about to enter Port Macquarie, and Graham Thompson, who used to be in Stars and Big Combo, et cetera, mm-hmm, and also with me, Tomo's really straight, and he was driving. Harvey and I had the biggest night in Byron Bay. I was passed out on the back seat. I mean, I was just totally asleep. Yeah. And it was, I was wearing a leather jacket and my hair was matted, you know, because I was in the sun in the back window. Anyway, I could sense that we'd stopped, and there was a bit of a commotion, and Tomo got out of the car. And I kind of looked up, and there was two cops. And it was like, oh, God. and the car reeked of marijuana. I mean, it was like the air was thick with marijuana. I used to call Harvey Harry. And I went, oh, Jesus, Harry, you've done it again. Oh, sorry, I was about to say an expletive. I'll bleep that bit out myself, Karen.
Okay.
Anyway, so I said, oh, Jesus, what are we going to do? I said, we're all going to get busted. But the cop kept talking to Tomo, and I got out of the car, and I must have looked like hell. And the cop looked at me, and he went, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Richard Clapton. I went, yeah, sorry, is there a problem, officer?
Beautiful.
And he said, yeah, there's a problem. And he said, your mate here was like 20 kilometres over the speed limit or something like that. And honestly, the marijuana smoke, it had come right out. Every time we opened the car door, it was like a massive blast of marijuana smoke. And the cop could obviously smell it. And anyway, the cop said to me, mate, I'll tell you what. My brother, he's got the best restaurant in Port Macquarie. Now, if you promise me, and I'll check up on you, that you'll go and eat in my brother's restaurant, you know. I'll tell you what, see this ticket? I'll rip it up. I went, you got a deal, officer. You got a deal.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We'll have to have a drink one night, and I'll tell you the other 50.
Oh, mate, I absolutely look forward to it, buddy. I really, I really do. And listen, I thank you so much for your valuable time today. You have been an absolute delight. I've laughed all the way through, and so many great stories, mate. Good luck with the Palms at Crown on the 22nd of July, and also the Gov August 26th. And I want to see you down here as much as you can, because we in Melbourne and all over Australia, mate, we love Richard Clapton.
My absolute pleasure, Gavin. Thank you so much.
Gavin Wood's podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.